From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in the U.S. and their first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. We feature interviews with Paul McCartney.
People tell me stories now. They say they were watching that first Ed Sullivan show, and it's always the dad in the family who sort of says, them Beatles, he never likes us. And he always says, you know, those are Whigs.
And we hear from Ringo Starr. He says sometimes the screaming from the audience was so loud that they couldn't hear themselves play.
I could only do the downbeat, you know, check, 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 check. I couldn't do any fills or anything because they would just disappear into the cosmos.
Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Monuments Men. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Believe it or not, and if you're around my age, it's not easy to believe, it was 50 years ago today that the Beatles touched down at JFK Airport. Only 2 days later, they broke TV viewing records and changed music and fashion and history and basically an entire generation by appearing live on The Ed Sullivan Show. Today, we'll listen back to Terry's interviews with the two surviving Beatles, Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. And we'll start with a quick salute to the weekend when the Beatles invaded America. The golden anniversary of the Beatles on The Ed Sullivan Show, for me, really is TV gold. It was back in 1964, when people gathered in their living rooms to watch one of only three networks on their family's only TV set. Ed Sullivan's CBS variety show was one of the hit shows then, because he offered true variety. Comics, singers, even jugglers and magicians. If you didn't like what was on, wait a few minutes, and something completely different would show up. Why change channels? It was like vaudeville, transmitted through the small screen. Sullivan offered a weekly menu of the hottest showbiz acts, veteran performers, new up-and-coming ones, and some flat-out strange acts. The Ed Sullivan Show of February 9, 1964, had all of the above. First of all, and last of all, since the Beatles closed the show as well as opened it, you had the Fab Four themselves. The Beatles performed live on The Ed Sullivan Show for three successive weeks that February. I Wanna Hold Your Hand had just hit number one on the U.S. charts the week before, and the Beatles played that song on all three shows, keeping it in the top spot the entire month. The Beatles were a blast of fresh energy from overseas, and America was eager to embrace them. An estimated 73 million people saw that first Sullivan Show appearance. But also, on that same show, they saw other acts, which are far less memorable 50 years later. The poor guy who had to follow the Beatles that night was a Dutch magician named Fred Kaps in a pre-recorded bit doing card tricks.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Now, especially for this show tonight, I made an entirely new trick. I've never done this trick in public before, so this will be the first time I do this trick. I hope it won't be the last time. Now, this trick is done with five...
Impressionist Frank Gorshin was there, too, prefacing his act of celebrity impersonations by posing what turned out to be a very prescient hypothetical.
Now, from Hollywood, the brilliant impressionist Frank Gorshin. So let's have a very nice welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Well, it's election year, and once again, a lot of the Hollywood stars will be out campaigning for the candidates of both parties because of their interest in politics. Well, a funny thing occurred to me. What if these stars should suddenly decide to run for these offices themselves? They'd have no trouble getting votes because of their popularity. In just a short time, the stars will be running the country.
And the cast of the Broadway musical Oliver performed two numbers, one of which featured a young actor and singer named Davy Jones. 2 years later, he'd be starring in NBC's The Monkees, a rock group intentionally designed to emulate and imitate the Beatles.
I'd do anything for you, dear, anything for you, mean everything to me. I know that I'd go anywhere.
This weekend, the 50th anniversary of the Beatles on Ed Sullivan will be covered extensively by the media. CBS has a new primetime special scheduled to be shown 50 years to the minute after that Sullivan show from 1964. But I don't expect any of these tributes to play selections from Fred Kaps, Frank Gorshin, or Davy Jones. What you will hear all this weekend is the sound of the Beatles themselves, whipping the teen girls in the studio audience into a frightening frenzy. Surprisingly, Sullivan's staff didn't get the sound of the Beatles right until the third show. In the first show, John Lennon's mic was off most of the time. And in the second show, John's was on, but Paul's was off. But CBS sure captured the sound and the sight of those wild teenage girls. And in that one night, America was infected by Beatlemania. Terry Gross spoke with Ringo Starr in 1995 and asked him about his memories of appearing on that first Ed Sullivan show.
I thought, we come to America, and it was fabulous, and there was millions of people at the airport, and there were lying in the streets, and it was yeah, all over the place. And just my impression was Ed Sullivan, you know, I'm waiting for Ed to say, you know, they are, they're all the way from England, and it's great, and they're going to be fabulous, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like Ed said, here they are, the Beatles.
Well, you probably couldn't
just
comprehend
like thrown,
the whole... Yeah.
Thrown to the lions. Right. So to this day, I've always thought, God, I mean, we could have done better than that, Ed.
Well, you probably were unfamiliar with the whole Ed Sullivan phenomenon. I mean, the most
low-key,
square person.
Yeah, we did not know what it meant. You know, this guy just booked us on a show. We'd go anywhere for a gig.
So how did the Beatles ask you to join the band after they asked Pete Best to leave it?
Well, they didn't do it that way, you see. Pete Best was still in the band, and I was with Rory.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Pete couldn't make the session, so they asked me to play. And we'd got to know each other in Germany because we were the two bands playing there, the Beatles and Rory Storm. So, you know, we really became friends there. Then we kept back to Liverpool, and Pete couldn't make it one day, and Brian Epstein came and said, would you play the lunchtime session? And I said, sure. And that was it. And then we went for a drink, and that was the end of the story. And then a couple of weeks later, he asked me again to play a couple of sessions, a couple of gigs. I said, sure, you know, because I just happened to have the time. And then I went away to play with Rory to a holiday camp in England, Butlin's Holiday Camp, where you go for 3 months, you play the summer there in the Rock and Calypso Hall. and we were the rock band. And Brian called me on the phone and he said, you know, would you like to join the Beatles? Well, I said, sure, I'd love to join the Beatles. And I said, when? And he said, today. And I said, well, I can't join today. That was a Wednesday in 1962. And I said, I can't play today because, you know, the band would be out of a job. We'd have to wait till Saturday because by then we could get another drummer. And that's what happened. And, you know, everybody knows the story from then on.
Well, an interesting part of the story is that you showed up for the first recording session of the Beatles. And the producer...
George Martin.
Yeah, I had another drummer all picked out because I guess he didn't know that you had been chosen to be in the band.
No, he didn't know. Well, he listened to the band with Pete Best and didn't think Pete was going to be on the session. And so he didn't know about me at all. And so he'd got this drummer, Andy White, ready, a professional drummer, a session drummer. And I came down and I was just mortified. And he said, oh, we've got this real drummer here. I said, well, what am I? And he didn't want to take a chance because in those days, it wasn't like you could go in the studio and just spend your time there. You know, the session was 3 hours. You were in and out, and that was it. So Andy played on the single, and, of course, then we re-recorded it, and I played on the album. And I sort of defy anyone to tell the difference. And that was it. But George Martin has apologized over and over again because I've made him for doing this to me.
Yes, actually, I think he continues the apologies in his new book.
I think he does.
Yeah.
And he did on Friday when I was with him.
So when you joined the band, did you have to do, you know, the Beatles haircut and the suit jacket?
Well, that's the famous line, you know, John came on the phone saying, welcome to the band, but you'll have to get your hair cut and get rid of your beard, and which I did. I didn't have much of a beard then, but I did have my hair swept back. And we had it cut so it fell forward. It was part of the image, and Brian Epstein was moving them into, like, this image thing too, making them wear suits and, you know, not drinking and smoking on stage. So it was all part of the deal.
Did that come easy for you? Were you comfortable with that? Or?
Oh, yeah, because I'd been in a group that had suits. You know, Rory... Storm and the Hurricane, we were the top band in Liverpool because we had suits. And, you know, everyone else was just in, like they are now, actually, all sort of scruffed up. But we were professionals. You know, it's all funny to think about it now, but that red suit meant so much.
Red, wow.
Red, and we had green suits, so we could change. Big doings in the 60s, I'll tell you, big doings.
No, in the Beatles, did you have to, like, figure out who you were going to be in terms of your public personality in the band? Because everybody in the band seemed to get this, you know, public persona.
Yeah, I think mine just came in naturally as Mr. Dopey. You know, it's sort of like the comic clown, you know. John had that edge. Paul was Mr. Lovable. Well, I was Mr. Lovable, but the young girls loved him. George was this silent type, and, you know, I was, hi, what's happening? And so that image, of course, especially through Hard Day's Night, is, you know, I've had to battle that since that day. Everybody thinks, oh, that's what he's like. And, of course, he's not like that at all.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like early on when the Beatles' fame started getting, like, so extraordinary that you couldn't go places without attracting crowds? I mean...
Well, you know, we were young boys, and it was exciting where we, you know, we sort of conquered England. That was the first job, you know. Just to get down to London and get in there was heavy enough. And then we'd do the continent. You know, we used to have this saying, oh, well, we've done Sweden, we've conquered Sweden. We've done France now, we've done Italy, you know. And then, of course, we were invited to come to America. And at that time, we were really worried because we'd had two records out here, or they were coming out. Nobody wanted them. And by chance, George came over for a holiday. He was the first one of us to come to America. And, of course, he was going into record shops saying, oh, have you got the Beatles? And they were saying, excuse me, never heard of them. So, you know, he came back saying, oh, they don't know us over there. And, of course, you know, the story goes when Capitol decided to put some money behind us to promote us, and we got off the plane to do Ed Sullivan. We had a number one. I mean, you know, you can't plan things like that. This is just how it is.
So when girls started screaming at your performances, did you have any idea what was going on? Like why the screaming as opposed to anything else?
It started in Liverpool, mm-hmm. and just.
So you actually knew where it started.
Oh, I mean, I was caught on like wildfire all over the world.
Was it frustrating to perform in concerts where you couldn't hear what you were playing because the audience was screaming so loudly?
It got frustrating in the end. At the beginning, it was just fabulous. I mean, you know, if you can imagine you're 22, 23, and you go on stage, and all those people are just screaming at you, loving you. I mean, you know, you were making a lot of records and making good records. You know, it was everything you dreamed of. And it just built up and built up. And, of course, around about 65, you know, it started actually to get a little tiring because, you know, we were starting to make really interesting records and we couldn't perform them. And it didn't matter what we did. People were screaming anyway, so no one was listening. And because of that, we were becoming, you know, not the best musicians we would become because we could only play, you know, the actual thing. I mean, for me personally, I, you know, it's very hard to do this on radio, but I could only do the downbeat, you know, check, 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 check. I couldn't do any fills or anything because they would just disappear into the, you know, into the cosmos. So you found yourself, you know, you're just sitting there playing the track, really.
Do you have a favorite phase of the Beatles' recording years?
You know, making the first records was just a thrill. I mean, it was absolutely thrilling. And listening to it on the radio, you know, we would stop the car when we'd be going to a gig somewhere. You'd know, you know, because they didn't play them every 10 minutes. Oh, it's 7:45 on Wednesday. They're going to play your record. And so wherever we were going, we'd stop the car. We're usually in a car and listen to it, you know. But and then, of course, from Rubber Soul on, you know, the record started to really get exciting. Oh, you know. The sound, we were really getting into the sound, making sounds, making good sounds. The writing was getting better. You know, everything was picking up. It was really getting good. So, you know, it had a natural progression. So, you know, to say this period or that period, they're all different periods. I mean, I like the White Album. That's one of my favorites just because I felt after Sgt. Pepper, which was brilliant, but it just doesn't happen to be my favorite. The White Album, we were getting back to being a band again. And, you know, that's what the Beatles were. We were a really cool band.
Ringo Starr speaking to Terry Gross in 1995. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
It won't be long, yeah. Everybody.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1995 interview with Ringo Starr. 50 years ago this weekend, he and Paul McCartney, John Lennon, and George Harrison performed on live American TV for the first time on CBS's The Ed Sullivan Show.
Can we talk a little bit about life before the Beatles?
Sure.
Well, you grew up in Liverpool. What was your neighborhood like?
Well, I was born at a very early age.
Yeah, right.
My neighborhood was real working class. I remember being conscious from a very early age that I wanted to get out of there because it was dark. It was just dark. It was just a dark neighborhood, you know. It was like they needed more street lights at night. But, of course, it was my neighborhood as a child, and I have, you know, wonderful memories of it. And the thrilling thing is that, you know, my memory of it, because I'd left it for years, was like, you know, this childhood memory that I had all these big avenues that we used to walk down. And then I went back and there's all these really narrow streets. So the memory plays games. But it was a loving neighborhood. I mean, the school was 3 minutes walk away. So, you know, it was a real neighborhood. There was a pub on nearly every corner, which I got to a little later. You know, and that, there was a park I used to walk to. One of my ambitions, which my mother used to tell me often, was I wanted to be a tramp. And so we used to walk everywhere. One of the reasons was, of course, because we couldn't afford to take a car or take a limo in those days, or a bus even. So we used to walk a lot. And I used to love that. And there was parks around us. So it was a very poor neighborhood, but childhood memories make it quite romantic.
I know your father left the family, I think, when you were three.
Yeah, he'd had enough.
So did your mother have a way of making money?
Yeah, she worked any job she could find. You know, I mean, I come from a working class family, but they call it lower working class when you've only got one parent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But my mother, God bless her, she did anything from scrubbing steps to working in a fruit shop to working in pubs. Anything she could to support us, because he forgot that part of the bargain.
Right. Mm. Now, I know when you were young, you had two long hospital stays.
Mm-hmm.
When you were six, your appendix burst, and
yeah. You
ended up getting an internal infection.
Peritonitis, it's called, yeah. That was pretty dangerous. It's still dangerous today, but in 1947, it was very dangerous.
So you were in the hospital for about a year.
I was in a year because 6 months in, I was getting rather well. And I got excited, and I fell out the bed.
Oh, no.
And ripped open all these stitches in my stomach, so they had to dive in again and sew me up.
Oh, gosh.
So we're lucky to be here, Terry.
Yeah. Well, then you got sick again when you were 13.
I know.
Well, tuberculosis, was it?
Yeah, but that was from the area I lived in.
Industrial stuff?
Where I lived, like, not every other home, but it was like, you know, six or seven cases in every street where people were just in the living room dying of TB because they didn't have a cure, of course. Mm. And again, God, you know, shone his light on me. In 1953 or 54, when they discovered streptomycin, and that's what saved me. So they shipped me off to a greenhouse in the country.
A greenhouse? Is it like a sanitarium?
Yeah, just a huge greenhouse where instead of flowers, they put all his kids in there. And let us breathe some decent air for a change and gave us streptomycin. And a year later, I came out of there.
So how did you keep busy while you were sick? Had music entered your life yet? Were you listening to a lot of it?
That's where it entered my life, was because to keep us busy, besides letting us knit, they used to let us knit dishcloths.
Oh, wow.
It was really exciting.
Yeah.
And then some teacher would come in with musical instruments, being drums, tambourines, maracas, triangles, all percussive stuff. And she'd put this big screen. I'm trying to let you visualize it out there, Radio Land. Big white paper with red notes for the drums, and yellow notes for the tambourines, and green notes for the triangles. And so she would point to these different colored symbols, and we would either hit whatever instrument we had. Well, I had a drum the first session, and I really loved it. And so they came back like a couple of weeks later, and they tried to give me another instrument, but I only wanted the drum, and that's where I really fell in love with drums.
So what was it like for you after you were sick to, or while you were sick even, to be playing an instrument that's so physically taxing?
Well, I didn't have an instrument for years later. I made my first kit when I came out of hospital out of biscuit tins and firewood. And then when I was about 16, I got a bass drum. That's all I had was a big bass drum. And then when I was 18, I got my first kit. So I'd strengthened up by then.
And how old were you when you were actually playing in a band?
1 month later.
After you got the kit?
Yeah. Because I was really lucky because if in those days, if you had the instrument, you were in the band. And because it was skiffle, so it was real easy. So that's how the guy next door, it was called Eddie Miles, but we formed the Eddie Clayton Skiffle Group. And he was the guitarist, and my best friend Roy Trafford was the other guitarist, and we got another guy on T-Chess bass, and we just went out there and played.
Ringo Starr speaking to Terry Gross in 1995. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From Netflix, with Season 2 of House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright, and Kate Mara. All episodes premiere on Friday, February 14th, on Netflix. And from eSurance, insurance for the modern world, offering online and mobile car insurance tools to guide customers from quote to claim. eSurance.com. This is NPR.
There is a place. Coming up, Paul McCartney talks about his boyhood friendship with John Lennon, who invited Paul to join his Liverpool skiffle band, The Quarrymen. He'll talk about the special bond they had that came from their similar family histories, and he'll share a poem he wrote for John Lennon after Lennon died. Also, David Edelstein reviews The Monuments Men.
I think of you and things you
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary this Sunday of the first live U.S. TV appearance by the Beatles on The Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. You've just heard Terry's interview with Ringo Starr. Now we'll listen back to her interview with the other surviving Beatle, Paul McCartney. This Sunday night, Starr and McCartney will reunite and perform on a CBS music special. Terry spoke to Paul McCartney in 2001 when he published a collection of old lyrics and new poetry called Blackbird Singing, Poems and Lyrics 1965 to 1999. Several of the poems were about McCartney's late wife, Linda, and were written shortly before and after her death. During their conversation, Terry asked Paul about the early reaction to the Beatles, not from the kids, but from their parents.
You know, when the Beatles started performing, the adults were up in arms about them, about your hair and about, you know, the silliness of the lyrics and everything. And but with Yesterday, like the nightclub adult performers started adding it to their acts.
Yeah.
Did that feel like a victory to you, or did you really not care what the adults were doing in their acts anyways?
No, it was very nice. It was very nice to have that because, you know, we thought what we were doing was quite good and we were proud of it. And there was this sort of backlash, particularly from the elder generation. People tell me stories now. They say they were watching that first Ed Sullivan show. And it's always the dad in the family who sort of says, "Bah, them Beatles, and he never likes us." And he always says, "You know, those are Whigs." They always thought the dads always swore. The kids saying, We knew they weren't. So it was always the problem. The dad was always the problem. So I suppose he was symbolic of the problem. So that when people started to like anything out of our repertoire, it was a certain victory. And Yesterday was a personal victory of mine. I mean, for instance, the great clarinetist Benny Goodman, who we had loved and thought was great talent, started for some reason, and maybe it was just a journalistic thing, but he came out against us. He said, "Oh, you know, I can't remember what he said." But, of course, we hated him from then on. And we started saying, "He's a lousy clarinetist. Anyway, what does he know, you know?" So there was this sort of group that didn't like us, that thought we weren't very good. So when Yesterday came out, I think a lot of them had to change the tune. And it eventually got recorded by way too many of them.
Right. So your friend Ivan introduced you to John Lennon. Do you remember what the band was playing the first time you heard John with the band The Quarrymen?
Yeah, they were. They had a repertoire of kind of folksy, sort of bluesy things, mixed with early rock and roll. And John and the band were playing a thing called "Come Go With Me," which was a record for a group called the Del Vikings. It was an early rock and roll record. But John obviously didn't have the record, and he probably heard it a few times on radio. And being so musical, he just picked it up. And so he was doing a version of it. But what impressed me was, even though he didn't know the words, he would make them up, and he'd steal words from sort of blues songs. So instead of the real words, which I don't know, but he was singing, come go with me down to the penitentiary," which was more off Big Bill Brunsey or somebody, you know. But I thought, you know, that's inventive, that's ingenious. So I warmed to him immediately hearing that.
And how were you invited to play with the band?
Well, they were doing two sets, and they were sitting around, and with all this time on their hands, John, who was 1.5 years older than me, had got hold of some beer from somewhere and was having a little drink. We were sitting around and just playing various songs. And even though I was left-handed, I'd kind of learned to turn the guitar upside down and just about play songs, because my friends wouldn't let me retune their guitars, obviously. Too inconvenient for them. So I'd had to learn this left-handed method. So I turned the guitar around. I think it was his guitar. And I played a song, an early Eddie Cochran song, which was called 20 Flight Rock. And I must have done it quite well because a couple of days later, I was cycling around Woolton, which was the area where I met John. One of the friends, a guy called Pete Shotton, cycled up to me and said, "Hey, we were talking about you. You know, we enjoyed that 20 Flight Rock. And would you like to be in the band, you know?" So I said, "Well, I'll have to consider this. You know, this is a big move to me. I'd never been in a professional outfit before. I'd never actually even hardly sung on stage before. I think I'd just done it once at a holiday camp somewhere." A couple of days later, I did and said, "Yeah, you know what? It wouldn't be a bad idea."
Now, I understand you missed the first date that you're supposed to play on with the Quarrymen because you were on a scout camping trip. And there's something I find so funny about that. I don't know whether it's because it's a sign of how young you were, or it was a choice between, you know, the proto band, you know, the band that later kind of became the Beatles, versus camping with the Boy Scouts.
Well, I mean, you've got to have priorities, haven't you, in life? Come on. The Scouts was kind of an official thing I took part in, and so if you missed it, you know, there was problems. Whereas this was a new venture, you know, the band, and let's face it, none of us knew it was going to lead to any of the heights it did lead to. So it was the kind of thing I was likely to pass up the band in favour of an important scouting gig. So that had to go, I'm afraid.
Now, your songs were co-credited, you know, in the Beatles era. My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that many of the songs were written by one of you or the other, although the other would do some editing on the song. But a few of the songs were actually true collaborations. Is that right? Is that accurate?
Yeah, well, what happened was, in the early days, they were pretty much... the very earliest days were separate. We wrote one or two separately before we actually got together. But when we got together and actually started writing the earliest Beatles stuff, everything was co-written. We hardly ever wrote things separate. But then, after a few years, and as we got a bit of success with the Beatles and didn't actually live together or weren't just always on the road together, sharing hotel rooms, then we had the luxury of writing stuff separately. So John would write something like Nowhere Man, sort of separately in his house in outside London, and I would write something like Yesterday, quite separately on my own. And as you say, we would come together and check them out against each other. Sometimes we would edit a line of each other's, but more often we'd just sort of say, yeah, that's great. And very often, a line that one of us was going to chuck out, we would encourage the other not to chuck out because it was a good line. I had a line in Hey Jude much later that said, the movement you need is on your shoulder. And I thought that was me just blocking out the line. And I said, I'll change that. He said, you won't, you know, that's the best line in it. And similarly, I would encourage him to keep lines in his songs that he didn't think were very good. And I'd say, no, that's a really great line. There was a song of his called Glass Onion, where he had a line about the walrus. Here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul. And he wanted to keep it, but he needed to check it with me. He said, what do you think about that line? I said, it's a great line. You know, it's a spoof on the way everyone was always reading into our songs. I said, here we go. You know, we give them another clue to follow. So we would check stuff against each other. It was obviously very handy for our writing to be able to do that.
Were you ever sorry that your songs were co-credited? Did you ever wish that you could get the composing credit for your songs, that it was clearer?
Well, it was an arrangement we made in the early days, very early days. And, of course, you know, a lot of people don't realise that our admiration goes back to people like Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hart. We loved a lot of the work of those people. And so we were looking for something similar. So Lennon McCartney grew up so that we would be a songwriting team in the tradition of those people. For the first few years, it was fine, and it never bothered us. But more recently, I must say, it started to bother me. What happened was, the kind of thing that would spark the feeling that they maybe should be better credited, the songs, was that Adrian Mitchell, who helped me edit my poetry book, did an anthology of verse where he had my poem, Blackbird, my song or poem, Blackbird, in it. And, of course, it was credited Blackbird by John Lennon and Paul McCartney, which was just not true. John hadn't had anything to do with that. So that kind of started me thinking. And then when we had the Beatles anthology record came out, I actually did request that on the song Yesterday, which was solely penned by me, that for the first time in 30 years, I'd be allowed to actually have my name in front of John's, not remove John's name, but that we credited Yesterday by Paul McCartney and John Lennon. As I say, John actually didn't have anything to do with the song at all. He didn't sing on it or play on it or write it. So I thought that was fair enough. And in actual fact, I wasn't allowed to do that. That was vetoed. I don't want any credit if John's stuff gets separately put in something like a poetry anthology. You know, I don't want any credit for Give Peace a Chance, even though I am credited on that. Some of John's stuff was purely John, and I'd rather it be that.
Paul McCartney speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2001 interview with Paul McCartney. She spoke to him when he was releasing a book named Blackbird Singing, a collection of old lyrics and new poems.
You have a poem for John in there. It's called Song for John. It's actually a lyric for a song that you recorded in 1982. But I was wondering if you could read it for us.
Okay. This poem's called Here Today. It was originally a song I recorded for John Lennon. And if I said I really knew you well, what would your answer be if you were here today? Well, knowing you, you'd probably laugh and say that we were worlds apart if you were here today. But as for me, I still remember how it was before, and I'm holding back the tears no more. I love you. What about the time we met? Well, I suppose you could say that we were playing hard to get, didn't understand a thing. But we could always sing. What about the night we cried? Because there wasn't any reason left to keep it all inside. Never understood a word. But you were always there with a smile. And if I say I really loved you and was glad you came along, then you were here today, for you were in my song. Here today.
When did you write this?
I wrote that shortly after John died. I wrote it in the upstairs room of what is now my recording studio.
What was the night that we cried that you referred to in the poem?
We were supposed to play a gig in Jacksonville, and we couldn't get in because it was some great hurricane. So we had to spend a night or two in Key West. And at that age, with that much time on our hands, we didn't really know what to do with it, except get drunk. And so that was what we did. And we stayed up all night, talking, like it was going out of style. And at some point early in the morning, I think we must have touched on some points that were really emotional, and we ended up crying, which was very unusual for us because we'd members of a band and young guys, we didn't do that kind of thing. So I always remembered it as a sort of important emotional landmark.
Do you remember what you were talking about that led to that?
Probably our mothers dying, because John and I shared that experience. My mother died when I was about 14, and his died shortly after, about a year or so after, I think. So this was a great bond John and I always had. We both knew the pain of it, and we both knew that we had to put on a brave face because we were sort of teenage guys, and you didn't talk about that kind of thing where we came from.
Now, that's the kind of thing that John really acted out through his music. I mean, he had a couple of songs that were really about that and were were very emotional. It's not the kind of thing you really did, though. None of the songs, as far as I know, were really about your mother.
Well, no, mine's veiled. My style is more veiled. And also, at the time the songs were written that you're talking about, like Mother, John was going through primal scream therapy.
Exactly, right.
And, you know, that's going to get it out of you.
Right.
I didn't actually go through any of that. I had my own sort of more private scream therapy. I think probably in songs like Yesterday, it's been put to me, although it's kind of subconscious, but it's been put to me that the song Yesterday was probably about my mother. Why she had to go, I don't know. She wouldn't say, I did something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Lest yesterday all my troubles were so far away. I'm sure that was to do with my mother dying. But as I said, the kind of age group we were then, it wasn't the done thing to talk about things like that.
Well, those two different approaches you had to dealing with your mother's musically is an example in a way of how you were different. What do you think you had in common musically and were most different about musically?
I think in common, I think we both loved music. We both loved the same kind of music, and it was a very large spectrum. People often think of John as quite a hard guy. In actual fact, he had a very soft center, and I was privileged to see that. So he would love songs like Little White Lies, which is an old song.
Walter Donaldson, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful song with some beautiful chord changes, and it's not the kind of thing you'd associate with John. He was quite a sentimental guy. And I think he had to cover it up more. I was very lucky. I had and still have a very large, supportive family. I've got relatives who are breeding as we speak. but John had a very... he had quite a small range. He had a very strange upbringing, actually, which didn't help his emotional profile. He was... He didn't live with his mother. He was brought up by his auntie. And then his uncle, his auntie's wife, Uncle George, died. And John, I remember telling me once that he felt that he was some sort of jinx on the male side of his family because his father had left home when John was three. So I think John always felt somehow guilty about that kind of stuff. So I'd always had the strength of my family. I'd been able to, I had people to talk to. So I think I'd been more open about that, and John wasn't able to talk about that quite so well, I think, until he was much older and therapy helped him. So what do we have in common? We had a deep love of music, a love of songwriting, which would stretch from very early old songs that were beautifully crafted to much later rock and roll songs through people like Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, through a lot of Elvis Presley stuff, through Chuck Berry, who to us was a great poet. I think Chuck is a great American poet. Bob Dylan is another who we both loved. So we had a love of music. As to what our differences were, I don't know, really. I don't really think about what our differences are. I prefer to think about what drew us together.
Paul McCartney speaking to Terry Gross in 2001. Terry also interviewed McCartney in 2012. You can listen to that interview at our website, freshair.npr.org. Sunday marks the 50th anniversary of the first live TV appearance by the Beatles in America on The Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new George Clooney movie, The Monuments Men. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The story of art stolen by the Nazis is ongoing. Works Hitler took from Jewish and other collections are still turning up and being claimed by rightful owners. A new movie provides the backstory. It's The Monuments Men, based on the book by Robert M. Edsel and Brett Witter about the team authorized to find and protect everything from the Mona Lisa to Michelangelo's David. George Clooney directed, co-wrote, and stars in the film, which also features Matt Damon and Cate Blanchett. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
George Clooney's The Monuments Men tells the largely true story of a squad of art experts who, near the end of World War II, are assigned to protect the masterworks of European society from Nazi theft and Allied bombardment. You'll notice those are two separate goals. The first is to stop the flood of art from occupied countries to Germany. Hitler, you see, isn't just a genocidal maniac, but also a pretentious aesthete who wants to dictate taste, who sells off what he doesn't want to fund his war machine and seizes the rest for a prospective super museum in his hometown. The Monuments Men's other goal is to keep Allied commanders from shelling particular targets, a tough case to make to men racked by the loss of troops and anxious to prevent further carnage. Who in such circumstances cares about a bunch of paintings or statues? Who indeed? One problem with the Monuments Men is that Clooney clearly wants to reach a mainstream American audience he thinks needs convincing art matters. Again and again, his character, Frank Stokes, makes speeches to make sure we understand what's at stake. The big speech comes early, when his team has traveled to Europe and dispersed among various countries. A colleague, played by John Goodman, helps him set up a radio link to his brothers in arms and art.
Monuments Men Radio is about to go live.
I hope we play music.
Calling London and all the ships at sea.
We read you loud and clear.
How far will this thing reach?
We'll find out tomorrow.
Roger that.
Are all the fellas there?
They are.
All right, listen up, fellas. As I think you should know the truth as I see it.
This mission is never designed to succeed. It's, if they were honest, they would tell us that.
They tell us that with this many people dying, who cares about art?
They're wrong, because it's exactly what we're fighting for our culture and for our way of life. You can wipe out a generation of people, you can burn their homes to the ground, and somehow they'll still come back. But if you destroy their achievements and their history, then it's like they never existed.
That's what Hitler wants. And it's the one thing we simply can't allow.
That's Clooney the politician. And the Monuments Men comes off as more of a, well, monument than a vital work of art. It's engaging, but a little blah, a little formulaic. It begins with a round-up the team sequence that's only charming because of who the actors are. Matt Damon is plucked from a ladder as he works on a church ceiling, and architect Bill Murray from leading a skyscraper tour. Alcoholic curator Hugh Bonneville gets offered a chance to come back from disgrace and redeem himself, heartwarmingly. Jean Dujardin of The Artist is a Frenchman who's there because he knows the territory. Bob Balaban is the ultra-serious specialist who trades witless insults with Murray. It's an all-star cast in which the stars are all low wattage. There's only one embarrassing subplot. It features Cate Blanchett as a prim, bespectacled French curator who secretly plots against a piggy SS man preparing trainloads of art for Der Führer's proposed Uber Museum. Ernest Damon has to prove to her he's not rounding up paintings to ship back to America. And when she's satisfied his aim is art for art's sake, she lets down her hair and becomes a real woman. Sacre bleu. Clooney must have been eager after helping to shape such acid, anti-imperialist movies as Syriana to make a hopeful, positive war picture with a light-hearted marching drum and woodwind score. But he plays everything so safe. He doesn't linger on the contrast between timeless masterpieces and the chaos and obscenity of war. He doesn't even linger on the masterpieces themselves. You barely see them. Worse, he panders to the audience. When the Monuments Men come up against snipers and murderous Nazi commandants, Stokes announces to his men that they finally earned the right to wear their uniforms. But if they need to take bullets to prove they're real soldiers, what are all those high-flown speeches about preserving civilization? The scale of the Nazi plunder is laid out better in the 2006 documentary The Rape of Europa, and the story is more thrillingly evoked in John Frankenheimer's 1964 The Train, featuring Paul Scofield as an art-obsessed Nazi and Burt Lancaster as the station master bent on keeping France's masterworks from reaching Germany. But The Monuments Men isn't terrible, coming in the wake of wars that have been far more morally confusing. It's an earnest tribute to decency, to good taste. The movie could have been called The Dainty Dozen.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed The Monuments Men, the new George Clooney movie. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
One, two, three, five!
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. From Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how two Iraq war veterans with PTSD, one with traumatic brain injury, came together, fell in love, and got married after the war. It wasn't easy dealing with violent mood swings, insomnia, depression, and other symptoms. We talk with Brian McGuff and Kayla Williams. Her new book is Plenty of Time When We Get Home. Join us.